الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله حي على الصلاة حي على الصلاة حي على الفلاح حي على الفلاح قد قامت الصلاة قد قامت الصلاة الله أكبر الله أكبر لا إله إلا الله
سفيسي ديال مكمل فرمانه بليز كومبليت ذا سورس اند شيت اند روز فيلين اول ذا جابس. الله اكبر الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر سمع الله لمن حمده الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله Allahu Akbar. Sami'a Allahu liman hamidah. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Sami'a Allahu liman hamidah. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Respected brothers, as the announcement was made yesterday, we have a special bayan which is going to be on the history of Spain and the 600-700 years of ruling, how the Muslims ruled there. Inshallah, this will all be explained in detail by Maulana Adil Tagari, who has already come to our masjid before and done history on Mughals. We've had history on Palestine. He is once here again to deliver a talk on history of Spain. As you know, that the masjid, our masjid is also taken, inshallah, during September month to the land of Spain. So for those that are going, and not only for those, all of us, we need to understand our own history of Islam in Spain. So I request all the brothers, inshallah, to participate after the remaining dua and take part in the bayan. Inshallah, it will be interactive. You will get a chance to ask questions. You'll have papers and pens. You can take notes, which will help you, inshallah, in future and to your trip, on the trip to Spain. Jazakallah. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ala sallam wa ala sallam. La ilaha illa anta subhanaka سبحان ربك رب العزة عما يصفون وسلام على المرسلين والحمد لله. If I can request all the brothers to come close forward to the member, Jazakallah. I can request all the brothers to come close. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Nahmaduhu wa nusalli wa nusallimu ala rasulina al-karim amma ba'd. Respected brothers, as you know, as we announced, we are very, you know, it's important for us to understand the history of our own Islamic history during the time where the Muslims ruled for 600 to 700 years in Spain. History itself, very important. Prophet and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran mentions many of the stories in the past, and that is also history, the Islamic history. And the reason these stories are mentioned is so that we take lesson, we understand where the Muslims or where the downfall of Muslims occurred in history. And that is why history is very important. And alhamdulillah, we are very lucky to have again Maulana Adil to explain this to us in detail. All the brothers, inshallah, kindly requested if they want, you can ask questions to Maulana, inshallah, at the end of the program. There's also pens and papers. If you would like to take notes and you would like to take down all the what Maulana says, inshallah, you are, please come forward, and inshallah, we will give you the papers and the patlas as well, inshallah. This will also be provided. Jazakallah. I will hand over to Maulana Saab to, inshallah, deliver his talk. Jazakallah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We begin by praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's wisdom, which is ever grand, which guides us towards the rise and fall of land. The Pharaohs, the Greeks, and Romans, with their great might, all succumb to Allah's light. Empires come and empires go. Their fates, Allah's hands bestow. Through time and change, His will is law. Praise be to Allah, we stand in awe. So, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I thought I'd sort of tweak the introductory sermon to sort of reflect the theme of these two sessions, which will be the rise and fall of civilizations. So, before we start, I know the main reason why we convened these sessions was because, primarily, number one, you guys are very fortunate that your mosque is organizing a trip to Spain itself. So, can I just have a quick show of hands? Who will be going to Spain with the group? That's odd. So the people who aren't going to Spain are here, but the people who aren't are. Okay, that's fine. Inshallah, yeah, maybe this will be. Is it being recorded? Okay, so.
We just finished the football.
We'll let them off. Maybe they're probably watching online. So that's number one. But number two, more importantly, is it's always fascinating and interesting to learn about history, but what's more important for us is to be able to connect the dots. So that's what we actually fail in. So do you know all of these facts and figures that I'm about to present? I'm not going to bombard you with them, but you can find them online. There are resources everywhere. What's more important for us is to create and forge a discerning mind, where you can read fact number one, and then fact number two, and then be able to draw a line between them, and then copy and paste onto our modern world. So that's why we actually study history. That's the most important reason. What I'm going to do first is I'm going to make it a little bit interactive. I know Mufti Saab said we've got the piece of paper here to make notes, but I know that's a bit of a dying art. So what's going to happen is, if I can have somebody to give out one paper each, and maybe a little bit unconventional, but I want you to try and pair up with somebody, because we're going to have a little bit of team trivia along the way. So I'll just throw some questions at you, and then you can write down the answer. I'll give you about 30 seconds. People at home can join in as well. So pair up with somebody. Create your dream team if you want. And we'll have, periodically, I'll just throw some questions out there. You can write them down. And then, I think I did tell Mufti Yusuf Saab, I might keep a track of the tally. So then tomorrow, I can maybe give out a little bit of a prize. Right, let me throw some quick fire questions. I don't expect the exact number, but a ballpark figure will do. So number one is, it might seem a little bit disconnected from what we're doing, but I'll be able to reel it back in. How long do you think, up until today, the USA has existed for? How long has it existed for? Just write it down. 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years. Yeah, obviously post-independent. So the United States of America, not as a British colony. So write that down. I'll accept good estimates as the correct answer. Okay, number two might be a little bit more specific. How long has the US maintained its stranglehold, or in geopolitics it's called hegemony? So they pretty much control the world, soft power or hard power. So how long has that taken place for? Because obviously, America wasn't born as a super hyperpower. It gradually reached that stage. I'll give you a hint, we're living through that period. We could possibly be on the cusp of its demise, but we're living through that period. It's less than 100 years, I'll tell you that. Less than 100 years. Okay. Yeah, don't want to give it away. Less than 50 years, actually. Okay, and final question. How long did Muslim Spain thrive and survive for? How long did Muslim Spain thrive and survive for? So if you're listening to Mufti Saab, his announcement after Salah, then it's not the precise answer, but it's close. So how long has the USA existed for? How long has it maintained its worldwide hegemony for? And how long did Muslim Spain thrive and survive? Both are important. Thrive and survive for. And by the way, I won't take this up to the wire, to Maghrib. That might be a bit cruel, so I think we'll probably finish off around 20 past 8. So about an hour. Sorry, 20 past 9. 20 past 9. Yeah, a disclaimer here is, as much as I'd love to go on rambling all night, I think we'll have to cut it off at some point. So if you're expecting a full post-mortem or autopsy of Muslim Spain, which is what actually, just on a side note, that's what we want to do historically. So whenever you come across any piece of Muslim history, don't approach it as entertainment or amusement. The best analogy I've come across is as a post-mortem. So the body's there. Muslim Spain fell centuries ago. So the body is lying in front of us. We need to grab our scalpels and cut it open and examine all the causes of death and demise. Okay, question number one. Does anybody have an answer? You just shout your answers out. No need to put your hands up. 6. I just want to focus on that. I like that answer. It's not correct, but this is why I want to focus on it. So 650. Anything else? So we had 110, 650, 2? 240. It's really close, actually. 250, that's even closer. 248. 248 years. But I love this brother's answer. Shall I tell you why? 650. Because of how much control America enacts in the world today. How they can just prosecute wars at will. Now have a look at the last post-World War II up until the early 2000s. The amount of coups and anti-coups and demonstrations and subterfuge and sabotage they've exacted across the world, especially in Latin America and in the Middle East, you'll think these guys have been around for centuries. But 248 is actually the answer. So I think brother over there, 250. And uncle over here, 240. So that's quite close. So 248. Right? So it's only been around for 248 years. Question number two. How long has it maintained its hegemony for? Just throw some answers. 60 years. 40, 35. Well, that's very close. Anything else? 30. You're right. About 33 years. About 33 years. Up until today. So what do we use as the benchmark? Well, it's after the fall of Soviet Russia. So 1991. So the fall of the USSR. It was a superpower, but we lived in a multipolar world. So the Soviets and their satellites, and then America, and then its cronies as well. But now, Soviet Russia doesn't exist anymore. It's just the nation state of Russia. So now, there's an open playing field for America. So for the last 33 years, it's been the lone gunman around the world. Okay, now the final question. Andalusia, how long Andalusia? I was using Muslim Spain. I'll introduce you to that after. Muslim Spain, how long did it thrive and survive for? 700 years. It's more than that, actually. 900 years. 900 years. 903 years, actually. 903 years. So just put that into context. America has only existed for 248 years, and it's only maintained hegemony and control over the world for 33 years, whereas Muslim Spain existed for just under a millennium, 1,000 years, so 903 years. So that takes into account when Muslims had sovereignty and when they were persecuted minority as well, so both. So that should put it into perspective. That should put it into perspective. And now, have a look at your textbooks. So do you have anybody here who's studying GCSE history? Or they've just come out of the school system? You look like you're in the school system. How old are you? 15. History is just not on your radar. You just fall asleep, doze off in class. Oh, geography. Okay, I doubt anybody. The main subjects that were covered would have been World War II, right? Everybody studied World War II. And everybody studied World War I. Right? And even those were from skewed perspectives, right? And these rose-tinted lenses. World War I wasn't about Germany. It wasn't about empires. It was about creating an Anglo-American world order. And this isn't conspiracy. This isn't a conspiracy theory. It's because we've been conditioned to such an extent we feel like anything which is a counter-narrative, we just dismiss it as a wacky conspiracy theory. But with World War I, genuinely, it wasn't about a fight of good versus evil. It was about Wall Street bankers, actually, and creating an Anglo-American order. And the best way to do that is a war. War is the best way to press the reset button. Anyway, that's beyond the scope of today's session. Okay, so I've lost my trail of thought here. Can anybody remind you what we were talking about before? Maybe I'm just saying this tactically to see if you've been paying attention.
Studying history.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, yes, yes, your GCSE history. And the World War II, we apotheosize, we deify Winston Churchill. Man was nothing but a racist Zionist. Let's put it as simply as that. And he would have been racist in his own backyard, but unfortunately for the Tories back then, they didn't have any brown people or people of color in the UK. Just before World War II. It was a post-World War migration. So he would have done the same here as he did in India. He was a man who supported the Zionist cause ardently. Anyway, that's all we ever cover. And even that's from one side. History is written by the victors. You'll never, ever, ever come across Spanish history. Muslim Spanish history. And there's a good reason for that. There's a good reason. Which is why Muslim Spain is actually known as Al-Firdaus al-Mafqud in Arabic. The lost paradise. But I'd actually rephrase it, not the lost paradise, the forbidden paradise. Because it's as if, strategically, Muslim history in Spain has been just swept under the carpet. For a couple of reasons. Number one is, Europe can't grapple with the fact that a Muslim polity existed in Europe. And it was the dominating civilization in Europe. It wasn't just there, just amongst everybody else. It was at the top of the food chain. It was the apex predator, Muslim Spain was. But they just can't grapple with that idea. In Spain today, geneticists and genealogists would say, their research concludes, every single Spaniard in Spain today has at least 1 to 10% North African DNA in them. So 1 to 10% North African DNA. So Muslim DNA, to an extent. And it could go before the Muslim stage, before the Muslims burst onto the scene. But definitely, for 1,000 years, there has to be some intermingling, some crossbreeding there, which there was. So they just can't grapple with that. It's something they just can't wrap their heads around. Why? Because the West is meant to be the stronghold and bastion of Christianity. Even though the greatest irony of ironies is Christianity is an Eastern product. Isa alayhi salam was a Palestinian, and Palestine is in the Middle East, so Christianity is Middle Eastern. But the West have monopolized it. So that's what happens. History is rewritten. And facts are then, you know, layers and layers and layers of propaganda are overlaid onto the true facts. So that you're either strategically forced to forget, or the narrative is shifted in a certain way. So you're moved into the periphery. So there are lots of things that have happened within what's called historiography. Historiography means, how do we study history? And the history that we have in front of us, how did we get it? And who made it? And what point of view were they writing it from? So it's the principles of history. So we're seeing now, we're seeing with European elections, we're seeing a tidal wave of far-right movements gaining ascendancy. And they all have the same fears, but they're phony fears, paranoia, of what the far-right called the Great Replacement. The Great Replacement, to put it crudely, the brown people are taking over at the expense of the white people. So we're losing our culture, we're losing our way of life, we're losing our cuisine, we're losing everything that makes us British or French or Italian. And the far right have actually inherited certain ideas which people who brush Spanish history under the carpet sort of peddled and propelled, actually. So that's reason number one. Reason number two is the West have always suffered from the superiority complex. And if we're now cast as the superheroes, then you need an attendant subhuman. So you can't have superheroes and then not have anybody else. There's a saying in Arabic, which is Al-Ashya du'araf bi-adadiha. Meaning, if you want to really properly appreciate something, and just have a look at the opposite. So, you can't appreciate a superhero if you don't know the limits and the limitations on the capabilities of a normal human. So, we need to have the superheroes, and then you need to have the subhumans as well. So, the Europeans have always cast themselves as the superhumans. Not always, I'd say within the last 600, 700 years. And the subhumans have to be somebody. So the subhumans, in our case, are the Arabs. Or the Arabs are the North Africans. For the entirety of Muslim history in Spain, the native Muslims, the Muslims in Spain were known as Moors. M-O-O-R-S. And a Moor comes from the Latin word, to an extent, Mori, which just means dark skin, or melanated, or black. Or it could come from Mauritania, which is in West Africa, Northwest Africa. So already here, they're designating a group of people based on their skin color. Because the idea was, the darker you are, then the more uncivilized, the more uncouth, the more unsophisticated, the more antediluvian, just ridiculously old-fashioned and backwards. So if you go back to the 20th century, this is the next question. I'm going to pick your brains quite a lot. What was the name of the Spanish dictator in the 20th century? There was only one. The name of the Spanish dictator who came to power around 1936. Franco. I was hoping you'd write it down, but I'll give the point to Uncle here. Franco was his name. Franco was his name. General Franco. This man was a hardcore Christian Catholic nationalist. And he also presided over the colonization of Morocco as well. the Spanish colonization of Morocco. So there's an adage that's attributed to him, and this pretty much sums up what was, until recently, the dominant attitude towards Muslim Spain. He said the Arabs came and the Arabs left. That's how he summed up Muslim Spain. He pretty much relegated it to a footnote of the Arabs came and the Arabs went. So up until his reign was still intact, about the 1970s, 1980s, this was the dominant attitude. After that, the barriers were broken down. He had a stranglehold over academia. So he pushed his own idea forward. And his own idea of Muslim Spain, and this is how he had rewritten the textbooks, actually. He had rewritten the textbooks. When he first came into power as a dictator, the first move he made was to alter the curriculum. And this was a curriculum that was targeted at the bourgeoisie, so the middle class in Spain. And the idea was, this was a curriculum that was used from the infant stage all the way till you graduated from university. It was quite comprehensive. And the idea was to push, to force down people's throats, the idea that that Spanish history has always been Catholic and has always been indigenously Spanish. And if anybody came from the outside, they were just pesky invaders that we can just swat away like flies. Even though, if I just want to sum this up, I know we're zipping from topic to topic, but I'll give you a very brief breakdown of the chronology in a second. There's an author called Richard Fletcher, and he pretty much sums it up. He says, without the contribution of science and learning and education, the Muslims gave, right? The Muslims bequeathed to the world, then Isaac Newton wouldn't have been able to do his job as a mathematician or as a scientist. It's quite a bold claim to make, but it comes from a non-Muslim historian. Historian par excellence. So nobody can say, well, he has a faith bias, because obviously Muslims want to portray their faith in the best possible light. He has no vested interest in this. He's just speaking objectively. So for him to say that means something. The reason why, one of the reasons why, the West is at its apex today, it's at the top of the world, is because of the learning that it acquired and, in a sense, inherited from the Muslims. And the Muslims had two civilizational centers. These were like the nuclei of contribution, of intellectual affairs and endeavors. I want you to write them down. Which ones do you think they were? I'll give you a hint. Right? I'll give you 30 seconds. There were two medieval meaning from the 600s to around the 1500s, two medieval, middle-aged centers of learning that were of worldwide repute. Two. One was in the east, one was in the west. One in the east, one in the west. So write them down. One in the east, one in the west. One of them is in absolute tatters today, unfortunately. In the east. The other one, some of you adventurers will be visiting in Spain. If not with Nur Islam, then sometime in the future. No, I went to Girona, which is Catalonia, near Barcelona. Not much Muslim history there, though, unfortunately. 3, 2, 1. Are we all ready? Okay, maybe I might pick some people. Uncle? Anyone? Okay, from the east. Oh, sorry, one on the side. My bad. Baghdad. Hit the nail on the head, mashallah. Baghdad in the east. Baghdad in the east. And the other one? Cordoba. Well done. Cordoba and Baghdad. So Baghdad under the Abbasids and Cordoba under the Umayyads. So these were centers of learning, of literacy, of civilizational progress. These were the only lights during the Dark Age. And again, another problem. When you first hear of the word medieval, then the connotations, the images that come to mind are of barbarism, of the plague, of squalor, of filth, of pure degeneracy. So it's just not a time you wanted to live in. But that's a misrepresentation, because Christians lived like that, Muslims didn't. London might have been like that, Paris might have been like that, but Cordoba wasn't. So let's not generalize here. But then again, generalization helps in propelling propaganda. If you paint everybody with the same brush and these broad strokes, then people will think, well, the Muslims were just lagging behind as well. But they weren't. During the peak, right, when the Muslims in Spain reached their summit of their existence in the 11th century, so the 10th century, the 900s, then you could walk for 10 miles in any direction in Cordoba, and you would have found paved roads that were lit at night by street lamps. And it would have taken around 700 years before London reached that point. You had donkeys that went around, organized by the municipality, that would collect your rubbish. This is in the 10th century, the so-called Dark Ages. The rest of the world, Europe, was steeped in ignorance, but not the Muslims. And intellectual endeavor. Two separate libraries in Europe. One was the Royal Library, which was under the patronage owned by Al-Hakam II, that had an X number of manuscripts and volumes. And then St. Gall's Monastery, so it wasn't even its own standalone library, it was a library inside of a monastery in Switzerland that held an X number of books and folios. So, question number three. How many books do you think were held in the St. Gall's Library, write this down, versus the number of books in the Royal Library in Cordoba? Massive disparity here. Huge. So how many in St. Gall's and how many in Cordoba? Okay, I'll have your answers now. Let's start with St. Gall's, Switzerland. Just throw some numbers at me, whatever you've written down. 500? 1,000? You guys are being too generous to me. 4,000? No, way too generous. 100. Less than that. 50. Less than that. Zero. Okay, not zero. they had some brains to them. 40. It's a nice round number, so it's probably not going to be exact, but a couple dozen probably. A couple dozen. Now let's zip over to Cordoba. How many do you think? 50,000. No, now you're being too cruel. 50,000. No, that's still too cruel. A bit less. 400,000. 400,000. This is in a royal library, by the way. A royal library. So imagine Keir Starmer having his own library. I mean, a ruler doesn't get time. Where would he find time to read these books? But he had 400,000 volumes in his library. So that should teach you something. Islam has always promoted a deep affinity with the literary arts. So the Muslims of Cordoba, of Spain in general, they would literally devour books, like some sort of a royal feast. So there was a communal spirit of book loving. So they're all bookworms. They're all bibliophiles to an extent. So it was really funny. In the 10th century, I mean, we can't really imagine this today, but in the 10th century in Spain, a man's social stature and his dignity was determined by the size of his personal library. So the lay people, businessmen, entrepreneurs would compete with the scholars. So the scholars would have books because they needed to use them. The businessmen would have them because how do I boost my social credit? It would be with books. So Al-Hakam II, the one who owned this royal library, he was what we know as a philosopher king. So he wasn't just a man of politics, he was a man of learning, he was a man of the arts. And he had this infatuation with books. So he'd have agents who'd be sent around the world to procure the rarest of manuscripts. And he'd be sat in his court and he'd offer very brazenly these challenges to his courtiers. And he'd say, if anybody can bring me a book from any corner of the earth that I can't find in my own royal library, then I'll promise you a handsome reward of that book's equivalent in gold, the weight of the book. And these weren't, you know, light paperback books. These were heavy tomes, massive books. And to my knowledge, that challenge was never met. There was, at the turn of the 10th century, so I think at the turn of the 900s, in France, there was a pope. And his name skipped my mind because there were so many of them. And to be fair, most of them were quite insignificant. But the pope was presiding over a church session. And in front of his crowd, from their perspective, he started dabbling in the dark arts. He started doing sorcery in front of them. Do you know what that sorcery actually was? He was just doing basic maths. He was doing basic arithmetic in front of them. And because they were so illiterate, they were dumbfounded. They thought, what's this witchcraft that he's trying to, you know, spellbound us all with? And it just so happened that during his infancy, he was actually educated in Spain. So maybe not the Muslim section, but in Spain, one of the Christian strongholds, which inevitably would have been influenced by Muslim learning. So he spent his youth there. He picked up basic skills that a child would have today, like literacy and numeracy. And then he took it back and he was seen as a sorcerer because it was unheard of for somebody to know how to use numbers. And all of that from Spain. So the Renaissance, right, where Europe rediscovered itself, rediscovered the Greeks. Greek writing, Greek philosophy, Latin philosophy, the works of the Indians and the Persians of old, that had been lost for centuries until rediscovered by the Muslims. And the Muslims had translated, and the Muslims had contributed, and they'd amended, and they'd then integrated those ideas. And then when they were done, they passed them on to the Europeans. So King Charles actually has a speech, quite interestingly. This was a speech he delivered at, I think it was the Oxford Union. Really long speech, don't have time to quote it today. But he pretty much sets the record straight. He says Muslim Spain wasn't just a storage container or a repository that just took on Greek knowledge, kept it in cold storage, and then passed it on. They took it on board, and they contributed, they added with their own originality and creativity, and then they passed it on. So again, this is another trend. So what will likely happen is, when the masses are illiterate historically, then the elite, and this is, it's all about politics. So the politicians and their, you know, academic mercenaries will try to literally efface history. So throw it out the back window. It doesn't exist. When people become a little more historically savvy, then they can no longer afford to just say, well, it never existed. They have to bring it back, but in a more diluted form. And then the more people challenge them, the more they'll have to undo all those, you know, redactions. They'll have to stop erasing, and they'll have to, you know, pull back the tape and the curtains. So what happened for a long time in Europe was Muslim Spain didn't exist. The only context Muslim Spain was brought about in any historical debate, was Muslim Spain was a useful catalyst or a stepping stone for the Christians to unite and then forge their own national identity. So Muslims were just there, they were the enemy, Christians united against them, and because of our war, this is genuinely a historical perception. The modern day Spanish identity was built in the crucible of war, in the arena between Muslims and Spaniards. We can't even use Spaniards because Muslims were Spaniards. Muslims were indigenous. Between the Muslims and the Christians. It didn't exist. But then when people started to become a little more perceptive, then academics could no longer afford to just say it didn't exist because they would be pulled up on it. Their academic integrity would be tarnished. So toward the end of the 1900s, the 1800s, the 19th century, an academic started to take a little bit of a U-turn. So they said, and these were some of the academics who were used by Franco. So Franco had his own army of academics, right, that he used to rewrite history. So some of them and their predecessors had the idea that, okay, you know what, Muslim Spain existed. But the achievements of the Muslims in Spain, if we're going to have to acknowledge it, we're going to acknowledge it on our own terms. The achievements of the Muslims in Spain was down to not Arabness or Islam, but because of this all-pervasive Spanish aura, the Spanish spirit, as they called it. So Spain, Muslim Spain was great, not because of the Muslims part, but because of the Spain part. So Spain is some magical wonderland. Anybody who enters, they automatically become a civilization, an enlightened civilization. So let's deny and downplay the Islamic aspect. Let's deny and downplay the Arab aspect. But now works are being produced in droves saying you can't ignore Islam. You can't ignore how Islam influenced all of these changes. You can't ignore how Islam was the one that propelled societies forward, skyrocketed them. Why was, do you think, Cordoba? Why do you think it was so alive and vibrant from a literary point of view? Because the first word Allah revealed was Iqra, which is to read. That's why Muslims have always been a bookish civilization. Muslims have always been people who've been attached to books and to learning and to education. Because the first word Allah revealed to us was read. And Sheikh Habannaka from Syria, he said, Iqra doesn't just mean to read, there's another layer to that, which is to understand. Read and understand. Read, understand, and then absorb, register, implement, and then throw it back out of the world. So that's just a little bit of a glimpse. Final point about Cordoba. So there was a nun who confined herself to a nunnery in Germany. So she would never have even stepped foot into Spain. Right? She probably didn't even step foot out of the nunnery after she was admitted into that. But whenever passers-by would flock by her nunnery, then she'd ask them, have you just been to Spain? Tell me about Cordoba. So, famously, she's the one who gave the title and the epithet of the ornament of the world to Cordoba. Cordoba was the ornament of the world. So I know we're focusing on Cordoba, but Baghdad was the jewel of the world. Cordoba pretty much was a carbon copy of Baghdad, to an extent, up until the 900s. Anything that was trendy, fashionable, the new fad, the new craze in Baghdad, had to be imported into Cordoba. So Ibn Hawqal was a geographer and a traveler in the 10th century. And he said, look at the size here, size comparison. Right? So logistically, for a medieval polity and a state to provide services for people, Muslims were the ones who had the original welfare state, were the ones who had, there was free education, there was free rubbish collection, there were public bathhouses, and almost 900 in Cordoba, paved roads. So you'd be living the luxurious life in Cordoba. Fourth piece of trivia. What was the population of Baghdad in the 10th century? You can write that down. What was the population of Cordoba in the 10th century? And what was the population of London, the most populous city in Europe at that time, besides Muslim Spain? So, what was the population of Baghdad in the 10th century? Population of Cordoba and then population of London. Again, we can never be too dogmatic about these statistics because it was a long time ago. But we have a sort of an estimate, rough estimate. I'll give you 10 seconds, 15 seconds. So remember, Baghdad was civilizationally superior. Baghdad was the antecedent. Baghdad was a template. Okay, we'll start with London. London and Paris, they had similar populations. Anyone? Just throw some figures at me. 70 or 17? No, less than 70,000. About 20,000. About 15,000 to 20,000. Within that bracket. So just to give you a rough idea, I don't know about Blackburn, but Preston has around 75,000 inhabitants. But we're talking about a modern state, right? So we've got technology at our fingertips, so it's easier to deliver for a population. But back then, without technology, you can imagine how difficult it would have been to just organize. Okay, what about Baghdad now? More than that. 1 million. 1 million people in Baghdad. 1 million. That's a mind-blowing figure. It might be a little bit less, but you get the idea. 1 million. Okay. Ibn Hawqal said the size of Cordoba was equivalent to one of the quadrants of Baghdad. So you can work your mathematical sorcery here if you want. 250,000, roughly, Cordoba. Around 250,000. So still, look at that comparison. 20,000 to 250,000. 20,000 to 250,000. Mind-blowing. Okay, so we've got around half an hour left. What I'm going to do is, this is how I've formulated these two sessions. Today, I need you to take away a chronology. So, these are probably the only two dates I expect you to remember. 7-11 is when Muslims first stepped onto Spain. It was known as, still is known as, the Iberian Peninsula. The Iberian Peninsula, because there was a river called the Ebro River, which was named by the Romans, the Ebro River. So, Ebro, Iberia. Iberian Peninsula. That term is more accurate to use, because if you say Spain, the Portuguese will say, what about us? Can't just leave us on the sidelines. So the Iberian Peninsula, and then even southern France would say, what about us? So southern France, just beyond the Pyrenees mountain range, Spain and Portugal, that's the Iberian Peninsula. The Arabic term, the Muslim term is Al-Andalus or Andalusia. Al-Andalus or Andalusia. So where did that come from? Andalusia is not actually an Arabic term. So we don't have time, but the people who inhabited the Iberian Peninsula, Andalusia, before the Muslims, were Germanic people. Germanic, they were tribes that came from what would translate to modern-day Germany. Around the River Rhine, or the Rhine Valley, as it was called. And around the 400s, the 5th century, start of the 5th century, then these Germanic people burst out of their very primitive dwellings. These Germanic people, Germanic tribes. And some of them moved southeast and took over Rome. That was the effective end of Rome. So Rome finished then, around the early 400s. So that's it, Rome finished. Rome was gone. And then the rest of them marched westwards. And they created small pockets of, if we can even call it civilization, in what's known as Gaul, which is modern-day France. So the French were also, the French before the Normans were also people from these Germanic designations. And then they made their way into Spain, Iberian Peninsula. Before then, it was ruled by the Romans. And the Romans worked their magic, like they normally do. You have to credit the Romans with due organization and with logistical superiority and paved roads as well. So these people came and they pretty much took over the land. And they were very backwards, very primitive, which is why they were known as the barbarians. So Rome was gone. These people toppled Rome. So that's no small feat. And there were lots of different Germanic tribes. There were the Swabians and there were the Visigoths and there were the Vandals. The main one, before the Muslims came, were the Visigoths. Right? You know, you hear the term Goth, Gothic architecture, or now it's more like a Gothic attitude or dress. Very dark, drab, dreary. And it comes from the Goths, because that's how their civilizational output was. Pretty much non-existent. But they were warriors par excellence, by the way. So they were brilliant swordsmen. They were brilliant warriors. And they were peerless on the battlefield. So before the Visigoths were the Vandals. So the Vandals called the Iberian Peninsula, in their own language, Tamurt Vandalus, the land of the Vandals. And when the Muslims came, Tamurt Vandalus was Arabicized, so just taken from the Vandal language and just plonked into Arabic, changed a little bit, morphed into Andalusia, Al-Andalus. So the land of the Vandals. But the name stuck. The Vandals ceased to exist in that region, but the name stuck. So we're going to use Andalusia from now. Vandal, there is a connection as well. Yeah, so vandalism, Vandal, you can see they don't have good connotations. negative representation in the English language. Okay, so 711. That's when the Muslims first stepped foot onto the Iberian Peninsula or Andalusia. And 1614 is when the last overt Muslim. When I say overt, I mean externally they look Muslim. And they were still practicing Muslims, as opposed to a crypto Muslim, so a secret Muslim, having to practice Islam underground. So 1614, 711 to 1614. When I bring the PowerPoint tomorrow, then there'll just be a quick overview of each period. So 711 to 1614, those are your two dates. Those are your two dates. So I'll quickly run through it in 15 minutes, but I think this is even more important. It's even more important. There's a grave danger of dismissing our past, which is we will then be bound by a cycle that repeats these same disastrous blunders in our personal lives and in our societal lives. So history is cyclical in nature. It goes around. So there is hardly ever anything that happens which is completely, totally novel, as if it's never, ever happened before. There are a couple of things. Like, for example, Muslims living without a khalifa. That's never happened before. For a long, protracted period of time. Or modernity. So Western ideas that encroach into Muslim lands with such force and ferocity. Never really happened in Muslim history before. So that's why our modern era is different. Very different. But generally, trends can be discerned throughout history. I haven't just pulled that out of my back pocket. Allah says in the Quran, وَلَن تَجِدَ لِسُنَّةِ اللَّهِ تَبْدِيلًا. You will never find any corruption or any alteration of Allah's sunnah. What's Allah's sunnah? We know the Prophet has a sunnah, his custom, or his way of being, or his comportment, or his behavior. But what's the sunnah of Allah? The sunnah of Allah, you can translate it as the civilizational norms. The rise and falls of civilizations. They're all governed by Allah's laws. So Allah has laws of physics, the laws of science. Allah is the one who created them and set them into motion. Similarly, we have the laws of civilization that govern the prosperity and then the depravity of civilizations. There are two things, Shaykh Abu al-Hasan Ali Nadwi used to say. There are two things that can never ever be predicted. Even though everybody, when it comes to politics, everybody likes to turn into a psychic. So they can predict the future, and this is my forecast, and become a bit self-opinionated. But you can just never guess. Like Blackburn, nobody would have... Most commentators were saying Blackburn was going to go to Labour. But then overnight, and then it just happens like that. So you can just never ever, Shaykh Abu al-Hasan Ali Nadwi, you can never ever ever fully predict two things. Number one is when somebody's about to doze off, when somebody's about to fall asleep. You could be sat there doing something you really enjoy and then you just nod off. And number two, the combustion of a civilization, its decline and its disappearance. You can just never, you just can't predict it. You can't predict it. Like Rome, for example. Rome was at the height of its power. When I say power, I don't mean political power, but I mean civilizational power. The people in Rome lived in opulence. Have a look at all of these portraits and these stuccos and oil paintings of Rome, and you'll get these pictures of decadence, and everybody's just lounging without any clothes on in a public bath, and they're all living the life, and they're all dressed in stately attire. And then the next day, what happened? These Germanic tribes, people who were held with contempt, like, who are you? Germanic people. Don't even know where you've come from. And they toppled Rome. Done. So Rome was built in a day. Rome wasn't built in a day, but it fell in a day. Rome wasn't built in a day. It's a famous adage. It takes time to do something, but it fell in a day. So when Shaykh Abu al-Hasan Ali Nadwi says, you can't predict sleep, then like the Prophet told us, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, sleep is the little sister of death. You can't predict death either. So death is unpredictable. The death of a person, miniature death, which is sleep, and the death of a civilization. So the reoccurring theme here is death. I know sometimes when a speaker comes up and then the topic's death, you might feel like, I've heard this a million times and just making me feel bad about myself. I'm enjoying something at home now, and I've got to go home with this lingering idea of death, and that's it. Just destroys everything. Which is what it's meant to do, actually. Hadhi min ladhat, as the Prophet said, just destroys everything. It's meant to do this as well with civilization. So don't feel too comfortable where you are, because you don't know where you'll be tomorrow. Actually, Abu al-Hasan al-Nadwi had this sort of it was as if he had a crystal ball in front of him. He went to Burma. I'm sure some people will remember, but he wrote about it. He went to Burma, and he said, look, you guys are living in opulence, right? You guys are high flyers. Just be careful. And then soon after, there was the economy crashed. And people who were millionaires turned into paupers overnight. But nobody could have ever anticipated that. So 711 to 1614. وَلَنْ تَجِدَ لِسُنَّةِ اللَّهِ تَبْدِيلًا Civilizational laws of Allah. And the final point here is, if there's anything that should propel you to study Spain in specific, now Muslim history is so vast and expansive, there are libraries that talk about just, for example, the Sokoto Caliphate in Nigeria from the 19th century. Right, libraries filled with books just about that specific incident. So, you'll all be working 9 to 5. Which period of history do I devote my attention to? After the Prophet's era and after the rightly guided caliphs, it has to be Spain. Forget about the Umayyads in Damascus, forget about the Abbasids in Baghdad. Even as important as Salah ad-Din is, I'd even say put Salah ad-Din to the side. And Muslim Spain has to be at the forefront. Because, I'll introduce you to this word, Muslim Spain is a microcosm. Microcosm, which means it's a miniature model. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam city in Medina was a microcosm, meaning you could use Medina as a template to build an entire empire, which is what people did. The companions did that. So you can use the upheavals and the vicissitudes and the changing fortunes of Muslim Spain as a template for life, because everything that happened across Muslim history happened in Spain. The good, the bad, the ugly, everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. Civilizational excellence, military prowess, heroes, villains, backstabbing, treachery. All of it happened in Spain. And something which never happened anywhere else up until that point in the Muslim world, which was can't really call it a genocide, it was an ethnocide. An ethnocide of Muslims. When the Muslims lost political power and sovereignty, they became an oppressed, persecuted minority. And that, in such a large scale, had never happened before in Muslim history. Where for nearly 150 years, these people lived under the thumb of the tyrannical Catholic rulers and the infamous office of the Inquisition. We'll get to that at the end. That's never happened. That had never happened before. This is before communism. Communism was bad. Muslims in Russia were forced underground, forced to practice Islam in a clandestine way. And because it's such a recent phenomenon, you can find people. You can find people. Me and Mufti Saab and my dad, we went to Bosnia in January. And that used to be a communist state. And you'll still find people there. And they'll reminisce, in a sense, because economically it was a peaceful, stable time. But religiously, everybody had to be on the same wavelength. So you couldn't distinguish yourself based on religion. So you're a Catholic and I'm a Muslim. No, no, no. We're all just in this together. We're all communists. We're all socialists. And they'll tell you how difficult it was, how you can't overtly practice your faith. If you were a Muslim, you were denied entry into these communist unions and you couldn't be part of parties. Especially in the Balkans, in Yugoslavia. But this was worse, way worse. A million times worse. So let's just quickly go through these periods, right? There's a lot more that I can say, but I'll just give you this for now. So from 711 till, you don't have to write down these dates, just appreciate it. From 711 till around 1031, the Umayyads ruled Spain. The Umayyads. So the Umayyads are people that descended from one of the ancestors of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Well, the brother of the Prophet's great-great-grandfather. So the brother of Hashim, the brother of Hashim. His name was Abd Shams. He had a son called Umayyah, and then all of these scions and descendants came from the family of Umayyah. Uthman radiallahu an came from the family of Umayyah. Muawiyah radiallahu an came from the family of Umayyah. Amr ibn al-As, family of Umayyah radiallahu an. Abu Sufyan radiallahu an, staunch director of antagonism against the Prophet. He ended up accepting Islam. He was from the Umayyads. So the Umayyads ruled in Damascus. So the Prophet came, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, 632 he passed away. Abu Bakr radiallahu an, 2 years, 634 he passed away. Umar radiallahu an, 10 years, up until 644, he passed away. And then the reins of the caliphate were taken over by Uthman radiallahu an, up until 656. And then you had the first bout of sedition where Uthman radiallahu an was assassinated, and in his own, he was accosted in his own house. And then Ali radiallahu an takes on the baton, and 661, he passed away. And his son is now propped up by the people of Iraq, which was Ali radiallahu an's base of operations. And then Hassan radiallahu an, he realizes, for the sake of unity, there's a better candidate here, Muawiyah radiallahu an. He's from the family of the Umayyad, so pass it on to him. Muawiyah became the caliph, 661. So 661 to 750, the Umayyads ruled Damascus, ruled from Damascus. There is no point, actually before that, on a side note, in politics, if you want to be the good guy, you can't survive, unfortunately. There is no such thing as a good guy in politics. There's just, it's just a case of damage control. Every now and again, the world will throw out somebody who's just phenomenal. But they never last, to be honest. Abu Bakr radiallahu an, 2 years. Right? He faced a lot of problems, but he managed to ride out the storms unscathed to an extent. Umar radiallahu an, assassinated. Uthman radiallahu an, assassinated. Ali radiallahu an, assassinated. So the best of the best, three of them, all assassinated. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, who was an Umayyad caliph, the great grandson of Umar radiallahu an, assassinated, poisoned by his own family, because he confiscated the illegal properties they held. They didn't like it. They were disempowered by him, so they plotted, conspired, poisoned him. So the Umayyads now take over. And they collapse in 750. The Abbasids take over them. The Abbasids were the descendants of Abbas radiallahu anhu, the Prophet's uncle. Now the Umayyads, what can I tell you about the Umayyads? They have a rotten reputation. Partly because of their own doings, but partly because, let me just put it like this. Labour have come into power now. So Labour for the next, what, 4 or 5 weeks will just slate the Tories. All problems in life because of the Tories. Right? Everything will just find its way back to the Conservative government. So you always try to portray your predecessor in the worst possible light. Politics is politics. The Abbasids did the same. The Abbasids had their own court chroniclers, people who'd write history for them. And the history they'd written was Umayyads were terrible, they were all indulgent, they were promiscuous, they were evil, they were evil, they committed illegal acts, and you know, at best, they were un-Islamic, and at worst, they were non-Muslims. Some of them, to an extent. So that's how bad things got. So the Umayyads have a rotten reputation, and that needs to be cleared up. The Umayyads, two stats I'll give you. They were veritably amazing. They had their problems, but you know, obviously hindsight's 20/20. I've sort of given the answer away, but you can write it down. Out of all the Muslim polities and states to have existed in history, which one commanded the largest landmass? Which one owned the most amount of land? Let's put it simply. Write it down. You had the Umayyads, you had the Abbasids, you had Salah ad-Din with his Ayyubids, you had the Ottomans. Can't really include any of the modern day states because they're only tiny. Maybe you had the early, the rightly guided caliphs, maybe even the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And now give me a landmass in kilometers squared. It wasn't going to be that easy. Landmass in kilometers squared. I'll give you 10 seconds. Out of all the Muslim states, bear in mind technology, advancements in weaponry, diplomatic relations, that all helps. Okay, answer for part number one, which is simple. Umayyads. The Umayyads. Now, how much land mass? At the peak, right, their territorial expansion had accumulated for them how many kilometers squared? More than a million. more than 2 million. A lot more than 2 million. 11 million kilometers squared. So from Sevilla in Spain to Samarkand in the Caucasus. Central Asia, sorry, not the Caucasus. Central Asia. So from Seville to Samarkand, and from the Horn of Africa all the way up until Armenia. So they bordered the Chinese Empire. This was within 100 years of the Prophet's demise, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Who would have thought? Within 100 years, Muslims control all of North Africa, parts of West Africa, the Iberian Peninsula. They had outposts in southern France as well. They were within, at one point in stage, they were within touching distance of Paris, about 100 kilometers away from Paris. Literally in the anniversary, the 100th anniversary, the centenary of the Prophet's demise, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, 732, 100 miles away from Paris. And then obviously all of the Middle East, then parts of Turkey, Armenia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, Far East, within 100 years of the Prophet's demise. And this is something that people don't really appreciate. We talk about unity. Unity is important. But politically speaking, the last time Muslims had unity, when I say unity, I mean every single piece of land that Muslims inhabit, every single tract of land was under Muslim control. That's what I mean by unity. Not we link arms and we sing Kumbaya, we're all brothers, which is important, but what I'm saying is politically, when has every single Muslim state, every single territory inhabited by Muslims been under the control of a central government, which in this case was the Khilafah? When do you think the year, pinpoint the year when that collapsed. Pinpoint the year when that central unity collapsed, where you had different Muslim actors within the same stage. So he owns this piece of land, and he's the ruler of that country, and he's the supreme leader of this region. Write it down. Which year? Which year? I'll give you a bit of a nudge. The Ottoman Caliphate combusted and was actually abolished, Ataturk, in 1924. Okay. Any takers for the answer? 7? That's very early. What makes you say that, Muftisab? But the Umayyads were taken out of the scene, so the Abbasid would have replaced the Umayyads. I won't confirm or deny, I'll just see. We've got 715, 1024. Anything else? Well, at least say 1924. The abolition of the Khilafah. Somebody say that? Okay, 1924. That's what most people assume. We were all one big happy family until 1924. Then along came the big bad wolf Ataturk, which he is. And then he ruined it all for us. So it's only been 100 years. We haven't had that political unity. Mufti Sahib's the closest. From the moment the Umayyads were taken out of power, were dethroned, the Muslim world has never fully united under one ruler. Never. And it first started with the secession and the breaking away of Muslim Spain. So this is where we get to. I mean, I could spend a couple of hours on this, but I'll condense it. This could be, we talk about entertainment, and we need a parallel Muslim entertainment system. So have our own media channels. I would even say have our own movies, have our own TV shows, just halalify it, if you want to say that. This, if it was to be adapted into a movie, it would give Hollywood blockbusters a run for their money. So the Umayyads were purged in 750. People didn't like the Umayyads for numerous reasons. The Abbasids came into power. There was a conspiracy. It was boiling under the surface for a couple of years. And then eventually all the disenfranchised members of community got together and overthrew the Umayyads. It was a brutal coup, a brutal overthrow of the Umayyads. The first Abbasid ruler's name was Abul Abbas As-Saffah, the bloodshedder. He gave a speech, his inauguration speech, like Starmer did the other day. But he said, "Ana as-Saffah al-Mubih, ana as-Thair al-Mubir." Ana as-Saffah al-Mubih, ana as-Thair al-Mubir. I am the bloodshedder, I am the destructive whirlwind. Out to hunt who? The Umayyads. Any remnant of the Umayyads, he was out to get. So he couldn't leave the earth and die whilst the Umayyads were still alive. Whilst one single Umayyad loyalist or any Umayyad family member still had breath in them. So he went on a killing spree, a rampage. Thousands of Umayyads were killed and murdered. He sent out Abbasid death squads and Abbasid assassins across the land. They even, just a symbolic act, they exhumed the dead bodies of caliphs like Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, one of the greater Umayyad ones, and started flogging it in public. And he died 10 years before that. So just bones. And they openly, publicly flogged the body. So whipped it. So they were hell-bent on destroying the Umayyads. Just to give you an idea, there's something called, infamously, the Last Supper. Not from the Christian law, but from Muslim law. So Abu al-Abbas, to mend relations as a move of reconciliation, he sent his messengers around the region and said, call all the Umayyad princes, all the Umayyad loyalists, all the Umayyad family members to a banquet. I want to make up with them. Let's start again, clean slate, shake hands. That's water under the bridge. We'll put everything behind us. Everybody made their way, hundreds of Umayyad members. And Abu al-Abbas, quite ominously, huge long table, he was sat at the end, and then he must have just motioned, clicked his fingers, and then guards sealed the door shut behind the vases that lined the room. The Abbasid assassins jumped out and slaughtered everyone, hacked and hewed all the Umayyads. And Abu al-Abbas sat there at the table just casually eating his meal. And then he jibed at the end. He jokingly said at the end, that was the best meal I've ever had. That was the best plate of food I've ever eaten. So a sanguinary, blood-shedding, blood-curdling scene, and he's there eating. But he didn't like the Umayyads. There was one man who managed to escape. One Umayyad prince. He was 19 years old. He was chased across the Euphrates River by Abbasid death squads. He saw his own brother beheaded on the banks. His brother ran out of breath, ran out of stamina. The Abbasid death squad said, come back, we'll give you amnesty. We'll let you go back to the caliph. The moment he landed on shore, they decapitated him. So he saw that. So he spent 6 years on the run. Just picture a map in your brain. He went from Damascus all the way to Spain or North Africa, Morocco, in about 6 years. An epic heroic tale. So he was on the run. He was a fugitive for 6 years. And he went from tribe to tribe, from people to people. And he came across the governor of North Africa. The governor of North Africa thought, I don't want an Umayyad prince in my midst, because then people will flock to him instead of me. So then people plotted to assassinate and kill him along the way. He had a terrible journey. And he had his trusty sidekick with him, a Greek slave called Badr. One Greek slave called Badr. And he was his trusty sidekick. He was his aide and he helped him in everything. And funny incidents, like he was making his way to North Africa because his mother was a Berber woman. Berbers are the indigenous people of North Africa before the Arabs came. Berber is not a politically correct term. Berber comes from the Latin barbaroi, which means barbarian. So they like to call themselves Amazigh, which is free people. Free people. So he was in the tent of a Berber chieftain, and Abbasid assassins were on the prowl. They'd managed to catch up to him. So the wife of the Berber chieftain must have had a massive long frock on, really big dress. So his name was Abdurrahman, by the way. Abdurrahman. He hid in the dress of the Berber chieftain's wife to escape detection from the Abbasid hit squads, and then he came out. And then he said, you know, I'll never ever forget this. And he never forgot that, because on his journey, he made his way to North Africa. The Nafsa tribe was where his mother was from. And across the pond, there are only 12 kilometers separating that, the Strait of Gibraltar, as it's called, the Strait of Gibraltar. And Gibraltar comes from the name British Overseas Territory. It comes from the word Jabal al-Tariq. Gibraltar is actually, it has Muslim origins, because the conqueror, the early conqueror of Muslim Spain was Tariq ibn Ziyad. Again, a Berber, so not an Arab. So he used that as his staging ground, as his base of operations, as his headquarters, and then he launched attacks into Spain from there, Jabal al-Tariq. Him and his commander. His commander was Musa ibn Nusayr, an Arab. So that happened in 711, and then they took over the land. Lots of things happened in between, the Great Berber Revolt, and then you had, you know, a long string of governors that were sent from Damascus, or they'd be sent from Qayrawan, which is in North Africa. Tomorrow we'll go into specific details. I'll pinpoint a few, and there were some really important telling lessons in there. So Abdurrahman, across the pond, he sent Badr. He found a whole caste of Umayyad loyalists in Spain who hadn't bowed down to Abbasid authority. This is 5 years down the line. And he said, you know what, this is perfect for me. So he started to campaign and canvass, and if it was in the modern day leaflet, and then he found lots of people, rallied them to his cause, and then he fought against the Arab overlords who were in charge. in Spain. They'd managed to assume power during the vacuum. And 756, the Umayyad Emirate of Cordoba was born. 756. And he had a long life, 30 years, filled with struggle. He never had a moment to rest. For over 30 years, there were Abbasid agents and operatives that were sent, and they were then tasked with bringing down the regime, the Umayyad government from within. He had to fight off against Berbers, he had to fight off against other Arabs, then he had to fight off against rulers that came from the north, so Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor, fight off against him. He actually took, so the city that I visited in Spain a few months ago was Girona. So he took Girona, he was at the gates of Saragossa, which is close to the frontier, the borderline with France, and he was sent back, and then the Muslims butchered the rear guard of his army, and then that became a defining moment for the French. So the idea of French as a language or French national identity was forged again in the aftermath of their army being absolutely decimated by the Muslims. So a lot happened, and he eventually died, and then he started the Umayyads in Spain. So they ceased to exist in Damascus, but they've just been transferred over to Spain. And they lasted up until 1031, when they were brought down by internecine warfare. So there was civil war between the Umayyads, and you had about lots of different pretenders, and then the Berbers became the kingmakers, and it was very messy. 1031, Cordoba ceased to be the center of power. And then you had a period called the Ta'ifa period. So now it was a free-for-all, like a Wild West. Many striking, uncanny parallels with what we see today in the Arab world. Everybody has their own states. Everybody's self-absorbed. They're pushing for their own interests. They couldn't care less about anybody else. They would have no qualms or moral compunctions calling over the Spaniards, the Christians from the north, to help fight against Muslims. So Muslims enlisting non-Muslims to fight against Muslims, and everybody looking for scraps of land, and it was terrible. But paradoxically, it was a time when literature boomed and blossomed. And then it got so bad, the Christians had taken Toledo, really important city. Alfonso VI, 1086, taken Toledo. And Muslims thought, that's it, this is the end. He's taken Toledo, he's going to march over to the rest of the south. And they eventually called the heroes from North Africa the Almoravids. The Almoravids were a Berber dynasty. They were led by a man called Yusuf ibn Tashfin. And Yusuf ibn Tashfin was like the earlier version of Salah ad-Din. So we lionize and we valorize Salah ad-Din, but Yusuf ibn Tashfin did it before Salah ad-Din. Salah ad-Din, not to diminish his accomplishments, he retook Jerusalem. But Yusuf ibn Tashfin was a selfless man. He was a centenarian, lived to 100. And he defeated the Christians, King Alfonso, 1092, Battle of Zallaqa. It was called Zallaqa because the Zal in Arabic means slippery. The battlefield was so slippery because there was blood spilled everywhere of Muslims and the Christians. And he defeated Alfonso at the age of 80. And this was the Almoravid Empire. It's known as the Almorabitun in Arabic. So they ruled Spain. So they said, you know what? These petty kings, Ta'ifas, petty statelets, just move out of the way because you're not worthy of ruling Andalusia. So they actually received a fatwa, a religious edict, from none other than Imam al-Ghazali to say, you have the authority to depose all of these petty kings. And when I say petty kings, they had a city. So you had a king in Seville, you had a king in Zaragoza, you had a king in Badajoz, you had a king in Valencia, you had a king in Granada, you had kings who were in charge of one small piece of land. And they just wanted more. They were narcissistic, self-obsessed. But some of them were commensurate poets. Some of them were brilliant military leaders and warriors. So the Almoravids take charge now. So if you go to Marrakesh today, then that was actually their seat of power. The Almorabitun, they're known as. Almorabitun meaning the frontier defenders. And they were very religious, very austere. And they were principled as well. And as the cycle of civilizations goes, which we'll talk about tomorrow, Ibn Khaldun's theory of civilizations, they lasted about 4 generations. And then they then stooped down to the lower level of decadence as the Andalusians themselves. So they're replaced by another Berber dynasty called the Al-Muwahidun, the Unitarians, in English known as the Almohads, around the 1100s, 1147, 1150s. So they said, the Almoravids have deteriorated, they're no longer fit to rule, we're going to rule over them. And the movement started with a man called Muhammad ibn Tumart. He studied in Baghdad under Imam al-Ghazali. He came back, declared himself as the Mahdi, declared his own caliphate, and then he said, I'm going to now rule. So he took over Marrakesh. Marrakesh is very important. Has anybody been to Marrakesh? So the main square, the Qutbiyya Mosque, right? The main square, that really long, massive tower, that was built by the Almohads. And their capital, the parallel capital for the Almohads in Spain was Seville. And you can see towers like this propped up here and there, based on the architectural formula of the Al-Qutbiyya Mosque. So there's a lot to see there. And the Almohads were in charge. And again, same, rise and fall of civilizations, to simplify it, not to oversimplify it, but to simplify it. They were good rulers, they were bad rulers, and then they lost 1212, the battle of Las Navas de Stolas, the last battle that pretty much signaled the end of Muslim rule in Spain. Sovereign rule, so where they have power, where they have executive authority. They were absolutely defeated and trounced. Yaqub al-Mansur was his name, the Almohad. And then after that, they had problems in Marrakesh, so they had to withdraw. And then in 1224, the last Almohad lieutenant in Spain withdrew. And while the Almohads went, the Andalusian Muslims were at the mercy of the Christians. And within the space of 20 years, Cordoba fell, 1231, Valencia fell, and Zaragoza had fallen as well. Everything had been lost. Now Muslims controlled only 15% of Spain, and that was Granada, led by the Banu al-Ahmar, or the Nasrids as they're called, the Nasrids. So they managed to cut a few sneaky and quite immoral deals, actually, with the Spanish monarchs from the north, with the Spanish kings. That's the only way they managed to preserve their own small little state. So the first deal Muhammad ibn Nasr made, he's the first king of Granada, the first deal he made was, you leave me alone, and I'll lend my forces to you, to the Christian king, to take over the neighboring Muslim state. So for the next, from around mid-1200s to 1492, and this was a miracle in and of itself, for 2.5 centuries it managed to last. So all the Muslims flocked to Granada as refugees, all the Muslims. So Granada was the last bastion and stronghold of faith in Spain. And you might think, they're hemmed in now. They're besieged by Christians. So they must have lived a terrible life. Let me redress that misconception. There was a saying, a famous adage for the Muslims in Cordoba, for the Muslims in Granada. It was, the worst affliction to suffer in Granada was blindness. Because you wouldn't be able to marvel at the gardens, at the architecture. You wouldn't be able to bask in the sun or absorb the climate or even, you know, admire how well-dressed everybody was. So Granada was living the life. And they managed to toe the line very, very tactfully and tactically. So one day they might be supporting the Christian states if it was advantageous for them, called realpolitik. So, you know, shifting alliances. And the next day, if the Christians weren't looking their way, then they'd launch offensives. And the moment the Christians turned back, then they'd move back. And they forged an alliance with another Berber dynasty in North Africa, the Hafsids. So the Hafsids had their own base of military operations, so they were helping each other out. So a lot happened. Then towards the end, there were inept rulers. The last ruler of Muslim Spain was Muhammad Abu Abdullah, or the Spaniards know him as Boabdil, King Boabdil. It's a corruption of the term. And he was completely incompetent. He actually rebelled against his father and his uncle, who were both carrying out miracle work to keep the Granadan state alive. And he was completely ineffective, and the Christians saw that, so they started to pounce. And they slowly moved in, and he was then isolated. And in 1491, he signed the Treaty of Granada. It was in 1491, the Treaty of Granada. That pretty much cemented the surrender of the Granadans. They capitulated to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. They both married each other to unite the two Christian kingdoms of Aragon and Castile. So now the Christians are unified, but the Muslims are in tatters. Muslims are in disarray. And it was all because of him, actually. Abu Abdullah, Bo Abdul. He purged the last hope of Muslims in Spain to hold on to their sovereignty. And Ferdinand and Isabella said in that treaty, we will acknowledge the rights of Muslims, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, they won't be touched. But the Jews can't have them here. So they were shipped off. They were purged immediately. Two choices, stay and convert, or be expelled. And they were expelled. Around 250,000 Sephardim, Jews from Spain are known as Sephardim. 250,000 Sephardim Jews. And do you know who took them in? The Ottoman Sultan, Bayezid II. Took all of them in, sent his ships, took them all in. Jewish refugees. Where's the anti-Semitism there? These people have historical amnesia, right? Anti-Semitism was, and still is, a wholly Christian European product. Championed by them. They perfected it. If it was rough around the edges, they did polish it. The Christians. But they need a scapegoat, so Muslims here. 250,000. And Bayezid II, actually, he would always joke with his courtiers. Do you know what? Every day I thank King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, because they've pretty much gifted me on a silver platter an entire workforce. 250,000 Jews. And these Jews were enterprising, they were entrepreneurs, they were experts in finance. And I've got an entire financial demographic with me now. So he resettled them in Istanbul and Thessalonica, which was in Greece. Now 1492. Everything was okay. This is where you now enter the period known as the period of the Moriscos. Morisco is a derogatory term the Spanish gave to Muslims. Morisco means a little Christian. A little Christian. From 1492 to 1614, Muslims, well, for about 7 years, they upheld. The monarchy upheld the agreement of the Treaty of Granada. And that was held in good faith. Until they brought into the scene a man known as Cardinal Cisneros, a church official, Catholic father, church father, and he propelled and pretty much brought to the fore what's known as the Spanish Inquisition. The Inquisition was a Catholic institution that was meant to, we talk about religious police in Islam, this was the Catholic religious police, the Catholic religious thugs and enforcers. Their job was to go around ensuring everybody was a true Catholic, and if you're not, burnt at the stake. If you failed the test, you'd be burnt at the stake. So the Muslims lasted for 7 years. Cardinal Cisneros was brought in and he had a vendetta against Muslims. And Muslims, for the next 20-30 years, lived a life we can't even imagine. Our time's almost up, so I'll end on this, just to give you an idea. The Muslims in Spain, the Muslims who lived in the Christian rule known as, in Spanish, it's called Mudejar. It comes from the Arabic word Mudejanun. Mudejanun means somebody who's been captured. So somebody who's domesticated, somebody who's servile, somebody who's an imposter even. That's what they were known as. They were seen as a fifth column. Forced conversion, mass forced conversion. You had to become a Catholic. There were mass baptisms taking place in the church. In 1502, and I'll end on this, just to give you a glimpse. And this lasted until 1615, until King Philip III in 1609 said, you know what, we've had enough of these Muslims, ship them off. Just get them out of here. So a lot of them migrated to North Africa. It was called the March of Death. Tens of thousands of men, women and children with minimal provisions marched all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, the southern shores of the Mediterranean Sea in Andalusia. And hundreds, thousands of them died. Little provisions. So the Mudejanun, as they're known as, sent a letter, an istifta, a question, to Mufti Ali Ahmad ibn Abi Jum'ah in Tilimsan, in North Africa. This is famous. It's known as the Fatwa of Oran. Oran is a place in Algeria. The Fatwa of Wahran. And in there, the Muslims said, what do we do? Because we're forced to eat pork. Inquisition officers would routinely stop travelers, feed them pork and give them wine as a litmus test. Are you actually Catholic? They weren't allowed to read Quran, so nobody ever had a full copy of the Quran in their houses. They had pages scattered around to avoid detection. They were forced to become swine herders, to work with the pigs. You weren't allowed to bathe. any overt sign of Islam, and you'll be taken and burnt at the stake. So if you bathe regularly, that was a sign you were a Muslim. Cleanliness, hygiene, sign you're a Muslim. So you'll be taken. If you would speak Arabic, then you were taken. So there was a law that banned Arabic, but there was a moratorium that annulled that law. But Arabic was banned for a period of time. So the Mufti of Wahran, he gave a fatwa. Can you imagine anybody even asking this? Mufti Sab's here. Nobody would have ever asked him a question as dire as this. And in the response, he didn't even want to say, I'm addressing this to the Muslims that are remaining, the Moriscos, because it might fall into the wrong hands, be intercepted by the Inquisition, and there'll be more trouble. So he said, I'm addressing this to Al-Ghuraba, Al-Ghuraba. Al-Ghuraba, the ones who are aliens in their own hometowns. And Al-Ghuraba, the ones who gain closest to Allah, because you're seen as different. Where did he get that word from? From a hadith. طُوبَى لِلْغُرَبَى. The Prophet ﷺ said, glad tidings be to the ones who are the imposters, to the aliens, to the interlopers, to the outsiders. Who are those? The Prophet said, those people who hang on to Islam at a time when it's more difficult than hanging on to, than grasping a piece of burning coal. That's the hadith he used in his address, in his fatwa. Addressed to the people who are al-ghuraba, al-ghuraba, like us to an extent, but not to this level of intensity. So in his fatwa, he said, and this goes to show, at no cost can we ever give up our package of rituals. No matter how dire the situation, you can't give up worship. He didn't say you can give up Quran, you can give up zakah, you don't have to do anything. He said, if you want to perform wudu, if you perform wudu, Muslims had to leave their doors open, by the way. Even if you were a Catholic convert, you were still held with an eye of suspicion and contempt because they knew you weren't actually a real Catholic. So your doors had to be left open in your houses. No privacy. Inquisition officers intruded at will. So he said, you can't perform wudu because all eyes are on you 24/7. So if you're passing by a fountain, dip your finger in the fountain, that's your wudu done. If you're passing by a wall, just brush the wall with your hand, that's your tayammum, your dry ablution done. You want to perform salah, use your eyes. He didn't say it's dropped. He didn't say, don't pray your salah. He said, even in dire situations like this, and bear in mind, 3 million Muslims died, were killed during this period of the Moriscos, and 2 million Jews. Still, he said, you can't give up your salah. Just use eyes. If you're forced to bow down in front of a statue of the Virgin Mary, then just pretend like that's the Qibla, and you're performing salah then. And if they will force you to say, Isa is the son of Allah, then say it, but be content with your faith inside. And change the words. So instead of saying Isa Ibnullah, say Isa Abdullah in your mind. As for giving zakah, just if you gift somebody something, that's your zakah done. And what about having a ritual bath? Just go for a swim. That's your ritual bath done. But at no cost should you give up your faith. That's what he said. Those who could migrate, migrate. Those who couldn't, then remain firm upon your faith. But it wasn't to be. 1614, the last remnants of Islam in Spain, Muslims were annihilated, were eviscerated. But the legacy of Islam still lives dormant within Muslim Spain. As a rule of thumb, any word that you see in Andalusia, now Andalusia is the southern autonomous region of Spain. There's actually a place in Spain called Andalusia. It's not the Muslim state of Andalusia, it's the autonomous region, like Catalonia. Anything beginning with an AL is most likely an Arab word. You can trace its origin back to an Arabic word, al. The Arabic article al, you'll find it everywhere. Al. You'll find remnants of the Islamic faith deposited within the elder generation of Spain. So there was a man, Christian Spanish man, and he said, my grandmother, who's very old, whenever she was tending to her flowers and her gardening and horticulture, for some odd reason, she'd always make an effort to bend her plants and flowers in a certain direction, which happened to be the Qibla. So then he asked, why on earth would you do something as strange as that? And she said, it's just a family tradition. Don't know why I do it, but I just do it. So Islam is still there. And they're seeing a resurgence today. So to finish, that's the chronology of Muslim Spain. 711 to 1614. I've missed out large chunks in the middle, but at least you know what happened, who were the main actors in the middle, and then how it all ended. So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he allows this information to seep into our brains. And this was meant to be more informative, Today's lesson was informative. Tomorrow, it's didactic. Didactic meaning you take morals and lessons back. Tomorrow's lesson session is, I'd say, arguably more interesting. Today, you just need to have that chronology, so you know where you're going and you can properly immerse yourself. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive our sins and to allow us to see a resurgence of Islam in Spain, and who knows, we might even see Islamic civilization in Spain again. Ameen. If you want to keep your trivia answer sheets, we'll need them for tomorrow as well.